Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic, although I feel even more like a man who's in two places at the same time tonight than I normally do on a Wednesday evening. I should let everybody know that I run two podcasts on Wednesday night. Obviously, we've got Fast Forward Radio going, and my work-related one, The Transparency Revolution, also has its live debut at this exact same time on Wednesday nights. And this week, my guest is a dynamic young fellow named Stephen Gordon. So people who just randomly happen upon Blog Talk Radio tonight are twice as likely to run into us as they would be on any normal Wednesday night. So it's a banner day, I would say. It's a lucky day for all the random Blog Talk Radio listeners, don't you think?
Yeah, our message to the world on that subject is you're welcome. Yeah.
Exactly. We just want to say you're welcome. Well, we were talking before the show started that we probably have enough content that if they wanted to, they could fill every slot on Blog Talk Radio for an hour, and they would just all be us talking, you know?
Yeah. We've been doing this show at Blog Talk Radio for how long now, Phil? Are we only like year three or four now at Blog Talk
Radio?
Well,
let's see. We're in year four and a half. We're coming up on five. Can you believe that?
Yeah, and then, and it's been a weekly show. I mean, last week was one of the rare weeks that we did not have a show on Blog Talk Radio. It was just kind of one of those weird times that just couldn't get it together to get the show done, but to get a show on Wednesday night. So that was a rare miss.
I'd say we've had, what, five of those over the last, maybe one a year, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe one a year that we just missed doing it. I mean, we're doing it on holidays. I mean, we just do it every single week because, quite frankly, we just enjoy doing it that much. So,
yes,
it's a labor of love. So we just do it in all the time. And if you could probably fill every slot if you wanted to with all reruns if you cared to. But anyway, that's a lot of good stuff. And check out the archives. It's some good stuff in there.
Check out the archives, folks. Coming up on about 8 months away from the 5-year anniversary, so we're closer to the 4-year anniversary than the 5-year. But when we hit that, that's going to be about 250 shows on there, not counting the ones we did prior to Blog Talk Radio. So, that puts us upwards of 275 shows. We'll be doing, by this time next year, we'll have done our 300th show. Imagine that.
That's pretty cool.
We're going to have to count up and make sure we know when we do that one, huh?
exactly. We've talked a lot about how you can get an education online. Well, you could do worse. You could do worse than listen to some old Fast Forward Radio. So there you go. So,
in all modesty, just listen to the ones where we've had guests. Okay, if you don't believe that you're going to get anything out of us, which you would, but if you don't believe that, just listen to the ones where we've had guests. We've had some of the most brilliant people in the world, literally. That's no exaggeration on this program over the last few years. And I go back and listen to those shows. There's an awful lot to be taken from those, particularly our World Transform series. That's something we're especially proud of. Well, we could sit here talking about how awesome we are all night, but I guess we should probably do a new show while we're at it. So anything interesting going on before we dive into abundance? Anything you want to share about this evening?
Well, if I seem just a little bit sluggish, it is Pi Day, and the kids and I and Sherilyn too all partook of a pie just prior to the show. So, you know, if I seem like, you know, I'm about to nod off or something, you know, just yell at me, Phil, and I'll wake right back up. We'll get right back into it.
Happy Pi Day, March 14th, 314, the first three digits of Pi. And I don't know if you've seen this, there's this viral image floating around on Facebook and Google Plus, and I'm sure elsewhere, and it shows a 3, a 1, and a 4, and then they're mirrored, and it's 4, the 1, and the 3, and they spell out pi. So it's like...
It's pretty cool. Yeah. They didn't have to fudge the way that it was, you know, you draw, or you, the way you write 3.14 to get a mirror image of pi. They didn't have to fudge that too much. It's pretty cool. I agree.
And do people get more specific with Pi Day? You know, do they say when it's 1-6 or something? You know, I don't know. Do you look at the time or anything? I guess just 3.14 is enough.
It's at 1:59 this afternoon. I really felt the need to eat more pie at that moment because 3.14, that's
when it absolutely kicks in. Yeah. Now, you know what? This is the first time I can remember ever thinking of this day as Pi Day. Has this been going on for a while?
Yeah. I think we've actually mentioned it. I think a guest mentioned it. Maybe last year or the year before. This is not the absolute first time it was brought up. But
Well, it's finally sinking in. So yeah. I'm gonna try to be prepared next year and have some low carb pie in the house. So tell me what you enjoyed. What kind of pie were you guys chowing down on?
Oh, we went with the traditional. It was apple pie.
Apple pie. Yeah. All right. Well, you
so
cannot go
mom on. Is there. Mom, apple pie. We did it.
You are the all American boy, Stephen.
I am the all American guy. So that's what we had.
Fantastic. All right. Well, happy Pi Day, one and all. And let's talk abundance. What do you say?
That sounds great.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, abundance, for those of y'all who have not read the book, and that would be probably most of the audience, because it is a brand new book. It just came out. The authors are Peter Diamandis and I believe it's Stephen Kotler.
Looks like Kotler.
Yeah, looks right. Stephen Kotler is a journalist and a writer by trade. Peter Diamandis is the famous guy.
So yeah, right.
They met at a TED and hit it off and thought, you know, maybe some of these ideas that they're being talked about at TED and that, you know, there's a book here. And of course there's a huge book here and I would highly, highly recommend it. Seems like we get one or maybe two awesome books a year on the subjects we talk about, Phil. And I would say that 2012's book is Abundance.
I would say so too. Absolutely. This is the book I have been most looking forward to ever since Matt Ridley's The Rational Optimist came out in 2010. And I would say great books to read together. I've also been reading a book that came out, I think it was last year, so maybe this was a good one to kind of bridge the two. Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature. This is the book where he goes into very great detail on the subject that has been covered in his extremely popular TED Talks, the ones where he shows that the world is actually getting less violent. This is the book that goes deep into the psychology and sociology and history of all that. And I'll tell you what, a person could do a lot worse if they haven't read anything on any of these topics to pick those three books. Pick those three, and then when you're ready for some serious delving, get The Singularity Is Near. And I'd say you're pretty much good to go, right?
Yeah, let me just throw out a real brief and to the point theory on why people are getting less violent. Throw this out as Stephen's theory, and I'm sure it's been voiced many times before, but I'm just going to throw it out. I think
okay,
people
go.
get less people have gotten less violent over the last 100 years or so because life sucks less. You get less cavalier with your life, and therefore the lives of others around you too. If things are going pretty well, and so as our lives have gotten better and as poverty has receded some, we just get less violent. So that's my thought.
I think it's true. I think when you read the book, there's really interesting stuff about this whole civilizing process. This whole process of becoming increasingly civilized is a really interesting. It's a really interesting progression to track, and it's fun for me living out west because the American West is used as one of these great examples of a place that was like really bad and then settled right down and is now the same as the rest of the U.S. and actually a pretty good exemplar to the rest of the world. You know, the U.S. actually has some problems with violence, but you know, not of the Rwanda variety, right? Not of that kind. And there's definitely a component of, you know, kind of the relationship between abundance and violence is that when quality of life improves, to your point, people calm down, right? I mean, you know, it's right. Like you've got more to protect, you've got more to lose, and you've got less motivation to go bash somebody upside the head, right? Because
right.
It's like you've already got all the stuff you need, suddenly that doesn't sound like as compelling a thing. And in fact, this is a nice bridge into abundance. We read about
right.
these kinds of improvements in the book. Now, you talked about Diamandis and Kotler and mentioned that he's the famous one. We should note that he's famous for a couple of things. First, for a number of startup companies that he was instrumental behind. He's been kind of a serial entrepreneur. But what he's most known for in our circles is he's the guy who founded the XPRIZE. And he's
right.
been the driver behind the XPRIZE Foundation. And so here is a man who takes the idea of accelerating change very seriously and who has made himself instrumental in making big changes occur. So he gets together with this journalist who's been tracking science for the past few years, and they write a book that is completely at odds with what you typically hear in the media. Not at odds at all with what you hear on Fast Forward Radio, completely at odds with what most people expect to hear, with what most people expect the future is going to be. And if you were to sum it up briefly, you know, what is the message in abundance? The message is that that the world is getting better. You know, they say that the future is better than you think. Things that we've been most concerned about: poverty, disease, war, all manner of strife, all manner of conflict. All of these things, all of these situations, are actually improving. That there's actually good reason to believe that we're not going to face a crisis around running out of energy, that there's actually good reason to believe that we're not going to face a crisis around the environment, that a lot of the big, big fears that people have are, if not misplaced, wildly exaggerated, and expectations of what good things can happen are just atrophied. They're not developed at all. So people are totally focused on massive negative outcomes that are unrealistic or unlikely, or that are being actively prevented currently, and have no concept of the sweeping positive outcomes that could be coming down the pipe. Is that a fair, do you think, assessment of what the book is all about?
Yes, and at the very beginning of the book, he kind of deals with that. He says, you know, we are wired as human beings. I mean, we developed in a time that was much more violent, and basically, you know, if we were basically developed to be people that spotted danger, and so we still have that in our makeup. We're always looking for the worst possible news. So newspapers, our media, it feeds that, because that's what, you know, we hunger to see is what's the worst possible news there is. And so that's why you get that in normal media. And so but he's saying it's just not true. You know, we have to keep defining poverty up and up and up in order to continue to have a poverty rate. It's of, you know, the people that are poor today all have flush toilets, cell phones, and, you know, in this country, and all the in luxuries that that the very wealthy didn't have 100 years ago. So he points it out, and he says that people that have pointed these things out tend to get really, really badly criticized, but never refuted. You know, it's, you can't refute it because it's just the right. And it's a great book for pointing out the truth and going against the grain and pointing out it's sorry to disappoint you with good news, but here it is. And,
yeah, you're just gonna have to swallow it. You know.
Exactly.
You're gonna have to eat it. Here it is. things are getting better. Well, in fact, early on in the book, there is a citation back to Matt Ridley, and on the subject of poverty. His prediction is that real poverty, absolute poverty, the real kind, where people don't have flush toilets and don't have electricity and can starve to death, that kind, which still exists and is still a big problem, he predicts will be gone from the planet by 2035. And that's not even 25 years. What, 21? Right, 23 years from now, right? We're a hop, skip, and a jump away from that occurring if that prediction is right. And let me tell you, if that prediction is off by 50 years, it's still wildly optimistic compared to what you would hear from just about anyone else.
And you know what? I'm gonna go out on a limb here and say that he's right, and it may even be sooner than that. And one of the reasons I would say that is, we're becoming a connected planet. People you got Maasai warriors that are carrying around cell phones. When you are connected and, some big problem arises, you can reach out and get help and you're plugged into the world at that point. And so that's in just a few years, we're talking just 5-10 years from now, we'll have a real-time voice translation on our cell phones too. So the Maasai warrior could give you a call, Phil, if there's a problem, and y'all could have a great conversation. Right now, there would be a bit of a language barrier, but there would be
a bit of a barrier, but real-time in my voice. This was actually, I had this on. Posted that on Better All the Time, the prototype of I don't know if it's real time, but it's in your voice language translation. And I don't know if you saw that link, Stephen, if that's what you were referring to, but I can't remember who it is that has it now. But actually, I'll just go over to Better All the Time and I'll just find it real quick here. It was
it might be Google. But anyway, yes, I did. I read exactly that. Microsoft, okay. So
yeah.
What happens with this is that I speak a phrase into my cell phone, and it not only translates it and then speaks it for the person on the other end of the line, or maybe out loud for the person standing next to me. It does it in my voice, so that they can, and that's pretty remarkable, isn't it, Phil? I mean, to. Not only it's not some machine voice or something like that, or some voice that would be, it doesn't sound like me at all, but it would be my voice, and that's
exactly. As I said over on Better All the Time, all it has to do is make the other guy's lips look like they're speaking English, and it'll be just like the universal translator on Star Trek, right?
Exactly.
that's the only step away, but it just goes to show you how open. And how connected and how much a single world we're becoming. You know, the book starts with this really amazing story that I had never heard before. I know a little something about the history of aluminum because I've written on this subject before. It's been of interest to me, and I know that it's actually one of the most abundant metals on earth. It is one of the most abundant things that we have, but not in its pure metallic form. It's locked in with other substances, and there are various processes that have to be applied in order to get the metal out of aluminum. So the book starts out and talks about in ancient times, they would have thought of him as alchemist, but some wise man comes before the Emperor Tiberius with this awesome new metal. You know, it's just almost as shiny as silver, and you can make weapons out of it, and it's light. And he has figured out a way to derive this stuff from clay. He says, we can take clay, and I can arm all of Rome for you. What a terrific invention. You know, the world is ready. Let's get going with aluminum. And, Stephen, what happens?
Tiberius, who has just, just hordes of gold, realizes that, hey, this is a metal that's now more precious than gold. You know, I can't have this because that would devalue the gold in my stores. And so he has the guy beheaded, and aluminum is lost to the world for about, 2,000 years?
About 2,000 years, roughly, yes.
Yes.
You know, the...
which really sucks, you know? it's a terrible story.
It's horrible, but it's a reminder that you can't keep progress down forever, actually.
Right.
But it's one of those stories you hear that and go, wow, wonder how much farther things would have advanced if aluminum had been available then. Although by the time it was first synthesized and produced in the, would have been 18th century, the initial techniques they came up with were pretty difficult, pretty laborious,
yeah.
And it was considered, to Tiberius's point, I suppose, a very precious metal for the first few decades.
Here's the story about it. It's, you had Napoleon there, and he is, you have Napoleon's soldiers that are eating with silverware, okay? Very nice,
right.
Silver, okay?
Yep.
Napoleon himself at this banquet is eating with gold utensils, okay, which is nicer than the
yeah.
rest of his men around him are eating with.
Yeah.
And their honored guest is given the most precious metal, utensils possible to eat his meal, and they were aluminum, and so that was, and so that's a pretty neat thing, and you go from that to now I got an aluminum can, I just drank my Diet Pepsi and I throw that thing away.
I mean, you're supposed to recycle it, but you think about a gum wrapper, you think about aluminum foil, people just, it's trash, right? They throw it away.
Yeah.
It's paper, or not even paper, because it is so abundant. It never would have been a real threat to gold. That's where Tiberius was wrong.
His point is that now here's the thing. It was, aluminum is, it's not the fact that aluminum is more, more precious than gold. It was that it was hard to get to because the technology wasn't there to get it out of the clay. And, it was all around but not obtainable because our tech was not in place, in the time of Napoleon or the time of Tiberius. Likewise, we are a planet made of water. Okay, we have 2/3 of the planet is water, and yet we have wars over water. And he's saying it's not that there's not water on this planet. It's just that the kind that we can drink is hard to come by. And he's saying, look, these things are solvable by technology. We can eliminate water problems, and we can do it within just a few years. That will take care of that problem. Less wars over water for one thing. For another thing, you'll have children that will not be dying over it. And he said, this is similar to the point we were making earlier about the world becoming less violent. Birth rates go down when people are civilized too, and the reason is, if your children aren't dying in childhood, then you tend to have smaller families. You don't have insurance births. And it sounds like a terrible way of putting it, but that's exactly what's going on.
That's what people do.
World.
I mean, it's counterintuitive, But the truth is that the exploding population is caused by primarily poverty.
Right.
There's always this fear that if you raise standard of living for these poor people who are having all these babies, they're gonna have more. And the reality is, has been demonstrated in numerous places over the last few decades, the opposite. That when you raise their standard of living, their children begin to survive birth, and they stop. When the infant mortality rate goes down, the number of children being born goes down because you don't have to keep packing the family just to make sure that one or two will make it all the way to adulthood to take care of you later when you're older. I mean, the term insurance is exactly right. What children are to people traditionally in the world, among all the other things that that they are to us, that we think of, in terms of being our family and people that we care about and all that stuff. But in the most practical terms, they are the people who are going to take care of you later when you're not able to take care of yourself. And so you have to have enough to make sure that one or two will make it that far, or else you're in a lot of trouble when you get old. I mean, it's a really serious problem when you're living in hand-to-mouth poverty, and it's a problem that diminishes immediately when people aren't experiencing that kind of poverty, and when they aren't experiencing those kinds of infant mortality rates. This book, actually, I was reading the section about water.
Yeah.
You could have a book just about that, okay? We could do a show just about that. It's astounding to consider just what clean water does for the planet, what it does, and when I say for the planet, I don't mean like for the environment, although there's all that to consider, but in terms of what it does for quality of life for individual human beings and for large populations of human beings, it's almost impossible to quantify how big a deal this is. How much hardship in the world is currently based on the fact that people are struggling to get water. In some areas, people spend a good deal of their day, particularly women. I think we were talking about this a couple weeks ago. Out seeking water, bringing it back, physically carrying it from the location where they can get some hopefully clean water and bring it back to where they are. And that's time lost from the day that could be spent doing, you name it, right? Educating their children, engaging in some kind of productive business, even keeping their own area clean. I mean, there are so many things that could be done that are lost in the pursuit of clean water. And there's water all around them, right? It's hardly ever because somebody's in a desert. It's usually because where they are, the water is so foul that people can't drink it, that it's a health risk to drink. So when you start turning that around, when you start making means of getting clean water available to people, and when you say, okay, there are places, there are deserts, there are places where people actually can't get water, when you start saying, we're going to take that salt water and we're going to make it into fresh water, which is it's a known set of processes, and actually there are a number of new ways of approaching that that are described in the book that are quite exciting. Water itself, just water, I think it stands to reshape this world in ways that are really hard to imagine. There's a quote I see here from your notes. Stephen has provided me a list of snippets from the book, and here's a quote from the book. It says, imagine a world of 9 billion people with clean water, nutritious food, affordable housing, personalized education, top-tier medical care, and non-polluting, ubiquitous energy. Building this better world is humanity's greatest challenge. And I think it's very telling that you go through that whole list, and that's a great list of things that you want to make happen. You go through that whole list, and item one, clean water.
Right, right. And he was very excited. Peter Diamantis is very excited about Dean Kamen's slingshot. It's a slingshot is what Dean Kamen calls his water purifier, and the reason he chose that name is it's the weapon used by David to slay Goliath. Okay, it's a giant problem. Not having water is a giant problem for the third world. Slingshot is Dean Kamen's answer to it, and I thought it was interesting what Peter Diamantis said about the slingshot. He said the slingshot is an extremely well-targeted family planning device. it's a prophylactic disguised as a drinking film.
Amazing.
You get clean water to these family members. You don't have babies dying of diarrhea, and when babies don't die of diarrhea, you don't have to have 10 babies. You can have 2, 1, 3. You can have a family of that size, and which is just fine. When you have smaller families like that, then you can imagine it's easier to feed a family like that too. And it's just things get better, when you have water. And like you said, Phil, once women are freed from the task of getting the water, which is, in the developing world, that's primarily a job that women do, then women can get educated. And when women get educated, something about women getting educated. It's one thing for a man to get educated, but it's for some reason, all of a sudden, when women get an education, you have civilization.
It's a good point. Yeah. There's something to be said for that. I mean, traditionally, in traditional societies where women don't work outside the home necessarily, where there wasn't a notion of women having careers, women who are educated, who have a certain amount of leisure time, which is enabled by things like clean water, and then ultimately by things like having a washing machine and stuff like that, they become the drivers of culture, right? I mean, they become the ones who say we need to have a public library, we need to improve this school, we need to, and they really do become this incredible civilizing force. Not to say that they don't do it when they're involved in careers, but it's like a very specific role that women fill in societies when you have these kind of traditional divisional labors. Of course, when you have women in the workforce, then suddenly you've got this interesting thing where you've got twice as many educated people and twice as many people in the workforce, and that has some pretty impressive economic impact too. So there's a lot of different ways to slice that up, but nothing bad happens, right? The more people you get educated, it seems that the more children you educate, the more men you educate, and absolutely the more women you educate, the better off the overall population is. And I love this image that the authors use in the book of a set of dominoes, that if you look at these challenges, everything that was on the list that I just read, they're stacked up like dominoes. You start knocking one of these down and it drives all the others. If you topple one challenge, they say, plenty of others will follow suit, and you end up in this positive feedback loop. And the first one obviously is, as we've been discussing, is water. Water is going to lead to just improved health, better food, better quality of life, more wealth, people living in better housing, people having leisure time to engage in business activities, people able to do more with their lives than they were doing before. And it opens everything up. One thing follows another. And what's really exciting, to jump just completely to the end of the book here for a second, or a little farther in, is the book talks about I don't want to use the wrong term, and this sounds terrible, so I'm not sure this is the right term, but are they the bottom billion?
That's what he does, and he refers to them as that.
Incorrect, I didn't invent it. Okay, good, fair enough. So I'm just quoting the book, but it just means economically that these are the people who have the least in the planet, and you know what? You bring them on board, okay? When there is no longer a bottom billion, when we're past 2035 or whenever the year is, and there's no longer a situation where some people are living in absolute destitution, when everyone has access to Khan Academy, okay, and everyone has economic opportunity, educational opportunity, the ability to make decisions and interact in this kind of global marketplace that you were talking about earlier, suddenly these people become players. Suddenly their ideas can become part of what helps drive things along, what helps make the world better. They're not just the people who need to be helped. They're ultimately the people who are going to be improving the world here in a few years themselves, not just their own circumstances, but contributing across the board, because everyone has something to contribute, and right now they're just sort of being left out of the conversation.
You know, it's almost a sickening thought of the Einsteins that we have missed out on. There are just as many geniuses per capita among the people of the developing world as anywhere else. And yet we do not have access to their genius. If they make it through childhood, and some of them don't, but if they make it through childhood, then they're probably just really, really clever subsistence farmers. And that's, you talk about a loss to the world. It really is. And, once these folks are plugged in, if for no other reason, we got to get these folks plugged in for selfish reasons, for the sake of all of us. We need the geniuses over there contributing to the conversation, just like in the developed world. I love these pictures that if you go to laptop.org. That's the one laptop per child website, okay?
Right,
they always have
right.
these pictures of these kids, with the one laptop per child XO little machines there, and they're learning and doing stuff with them, and the current picture at that website right now shows Uruguay. These kids just hanging out there next to a house. There, a couple of them have these little laptops there. And they're learning, and they're online too. And it's that is a real change. When these kids can learn and do just like kids everywhere else, it gives you hope for how that a country can change. And so he's saying Peter Diamandis is saying that's happening. That's something we could get to see happen. Easily within our lifetime, and that's exciting. And it's not just the programs that nonprofits that seek to target these huge needs in the developing world, like the One Laptop Per Child program, which is awesome. It's also you see things like the Raspberry Pi that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, which is a $35 computer. It's a computer. It's basically a naked circuit board, okay? And you plug in a monitor to it, you plug in a keyboard, and it's a full computer. It's like a desktop basically, and they sell that for $35. So
yeah, it's amazing. It seems to me that, well, if we wanted to, we could just spend the whole program talking about the exciting things that the book has to say about what's going to happen in the developing world, what is happening and what's likely to happen. But let's flip it around and let's talk about our side of the world, okay? Or let's talk about what will happen in the developing world once they're developed. What is there to look forward to for us? And it's really pretty astounding, the things that that are outlined in the book. One of the things that comes to mind, a topic that we get into quite frequently here, is energy. And I have a lot of Facebook friends. this is where I always seem to notice these discussions going on, so I'll just mention my Facebook friends, who are worried sick about peak oil.
Right.
Now, I wasn't all that worried about peak oil anyway, but I have to tell you, after I read the energy chapters in Abundance, I don't know how a rational person can be worried about peak oil. Okay, let me put it that way. Am I overstating the case, or
not at all?
Would you agree with it?
Not at all. There's lots of oil that's available to us that we're not drilling for right now. We're going to go through some pain here in the near future. Probably this year, we're going to see $5 gasoline this summer. Which is going to be bad. We're gonna have a time like that, but I'm gonna tell you, you got guys like Craig Venter, who's mentioned in Abundance, who is developing ways to get single celled organisms to produce any kind of fuel you like. You want jet fuel? Yeah, sure. We got we can engineer these little guys to give you as much jet fuel as you like. And they're even getting it to the point, Phil, that they don't even have to kill the little organisms to get the fuel. For a while it was like, okay, it's producing, you're getting diesel out of these guys, but of course you have to get the little guys and, out of it, and you have to get a new batch of diesel producing organisms to produce your next batch. Now they're not even doing that. They're just they're getting the diesel from them, and they just keep feeding these little guys, and then you get all the diesel you want, jet fuel, gasoline, anything, kerosene. And, you just tweak these their genetic code just a little bit, and you can get any kind you like. And they've got pilot facilities now that are beginning to produce some of this fuel. So if you're worried about that, you don't have to be. And you know what that's going to do, Phil, is it seems like the places that have lots of fuel, lots of petroleum, tend to end up being trouble spots in the world. And there's a reason for that. You've got leadership in those countries that depend, instead of on their people for their productivity, they depend on their natural resource. They've got a lot of petroleum. You don't have to worry about our people. In fact, screw our people. We'll get the oil. We'll sell it to America, and we can be a kleptocracy. We can steal all the oil for ourselves. We can live in these lavish palaces or whatever, and let everybody else be poor. Screw them. We're going to end up defunding those guys if all over the world everybody just produces the fuel they need. That is a huge positive development. You talk about all the, the trouble in the Middle East. You just solved it right there. Everybody's got their own oil. We don't care what you've got under your ground now. We've got it handled. And so all of a sudden, well, maybe we should, invest in our people now, and stop this nonsense with petroleum. So
yeah, I'm with you. I'm not 100% sure it would solve everything in the Middle East, but man, it would help. Okay, it would certainly.
Yeah, there's always religious disputes, but I think it would simmer things down a little bit.
It would turn the heat way down. And to me, I look at a prediction like peak oil, and I have, as I mentioned, I have friends who are worried sick about this. I mean, they're really convinced that this is about to happen. It's not just that that we don't seem to be running out of oil, which is kind of an interesting thing in its own right. They seem to keep finding a lot more oil than anybody ever thought existed, which is almost kind of funny. But there are these astounding ways of producing fuel. Truly, what Ventnor's come up with is, I think, kind of the first mass production nanofactory, right? It's being done with biology, with algae, but that's really what
and
you're talking about.
It's carbon neutral, Phil. It's carbon neutral too.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. You could say, well, if we run out of oil, we can always make it out of, we could always make gas out of coal, like the Germans did in World War II, and actually we would. Something like that would happen. The world would not shut down, even if oil started to diminish. We might even temporarily switch over to coal, but here you would have this completely renewable, carbon neutral resource that would produce, to your point, any kind of fuel you want. I mean, it's not like ethanol where you'd have a hard time running an airplane off it. You tweak the gene code of the algae, and yeah, you put out whatever jet fuel you need. So I'm a big believer that ultimately everything will run on electricity, and that one day we'll have batteries that will carry us through. But for the middle term, anyway, it looks like we're very dependent on liquid fuel, and I'm not worried that we're going to run out of liquid fuel. It looks to me like there are things ready to step in, better for the environment than what we're currently doing. And talk about abundant, algae is pond scum. Right. I mean, this is a hard thing to get rid of. It's not a hard thing to produce.
Exactly. And let's explain real quick why it's carbon neutral. The process requires you to put CO2 into the organisms. That's what these little guys breathe. okay? They have to have CO2 in order to produce your diesel. And so, you burn the fuel and it releases the CO2 again, but the CO2, you need, CO2 in high concentrations in order to make this fuel. So it's carbon neutral. And so carbon in and then carbon back out, but that's the point. It's carbon in first. You don't, unlike the fuel that you pull out of the ground and release into the atmosphere, that was carbon that was sequestered deep in the ground that's being released in the atmosphere. This could be atmospheric carbon put into these little guys in order to make the fuel that you burn. And so carbon neutral and just as abundant as you can possibly imagine.
And here's where I get really wound up, because we've just said all this about how peak oil is not going to happen and all this great stuff about a wonderful potential source of fuel to drive our cars. That is not even that is not even remotely the big news on energy. Okay, that's the beautiful thing about that. That's a really cool thing, and it's not even the big news. The big news, I think, derives around the fact that nuclear technology has improved so much and is on a trajectory to become much more widely adopted if people decide to go that route. And solar energy is improving in ways that I think people are not tracking with and don't understand, and is about to become important to us in ways that people just have no concept of. But it's going to not only address a lot of our energy problems, it's going to produce huge opportunities for us as a civilization, as a species. Things that haven't been possible before are going to become possible because we didn't have enough energy to do it before, and now we're going to have enough energy.
My parents put solar on the roof of their home, and it cut their electric bill in half, and they couldn't be more pleased. And of course, this is solar, and solar is improving in performance and halving in price, basically on an annual basis. And so you've got solar basically on about the same kind of track as Moore's law, and Phil, you had a blog post recently about solar, and I mean it was amazing the amount of negativity in the comments. These guys just weren't buying it. Well,
they were not. They were not.
Yeah, I would love to have a money bet with these guys, because it'd be a good I feel a little bit like taking their money, because they obviously just don't get it. They're prejudiced against good news. But anyway.
Exponential trends are really hard to grasp. It's hard to understand that. And I'm looking at one of the quotes from the book, and this is the part that people don't get. Right now, we get about 1% of our energy from solar. So it's like, it's a niche. It's a tiny niche. It doesn't matter. It's never going to matter. Solar's growing at a rate of about 30% a year. So we're about 18 years away from solar being able to supply 100% of our energy needs. I mean, that's where we are right now. Just following the track that we're on. But the track that we're on isn't even. I mean, that's just doing it in a linear way. Not even taking into consideration the performance improvement and the cost halvings that you were just talking about. When you put those two things together, we might get there a lot sooner. But even if we don't get there a lot sooner, within that period of time, we might get to a point where we're just talking about vastly more energy than we've ever had access to before. I mean, this is really the one of the big aha moments for me in reading this book was this notion that not only are we inundated with more energy than we could ever possibly use. I mean, we've been told that our whole lives. The first time anybody ever hears about solar energy, that's like the first thing they say, right? Is we got all this energy hitting the planet, and we hardly make use of any of it. But I mean, it's like that old saw that people say that you only use like 10% of your brain or a third of your brain or something like that. No one has ever then said, "And here, I'm going to throw a switch, and now you get to use the rest of your brain," right? that's what these guys are actually saying. They're saying, "Okay, we're about to throw the switch, and we're going to have enough energy." One of the quotes from the book that I see here that I just enjoyed so much: why not drop the price of energy by an order of magnitude, driving the planet's economic growth through the roof? We could truly open up the space frontier using that energy to send millions of people to the moon or Mars. With that amount of energy, you can supply every person on Earth with the American standard of fresh, clean water every day. And how about using that energy to actually remove CO2 from the Earth's atmosphere? And then he says, I know a professor at the University of Calgary, Dr. David Keith, who's developed such a machine. Back it up with cheap energy, and we might even solve global warming. I'm sure there's a much longer list of great examples. I mean, what can't – you know, we talked about water being this thing that solves – a multitude of problems in the developing world. Energy, I think, is the one that solves just about every problem in the developed world, right? I mean,
even if we didn't develop anything further as far as desalinization, even if we use today's technology for desalinization, if we had unlimited energy, we could desalinate so much water. That would cease to be a problem anyway. But that's, we're not going to be stuck with today's desalinization technology. We're going to have better technology and more energy. So it's
exactly.
Water's not going to be a problem. Energy's not going to be a problem. And once you solve those things, a lot of things begin settling down and things get better quick for a lot of people. So it's lots to be excited about. This book is just awesome, Phil. I mean, I can't recommend it highly enough.
I'll tell you, I am continually inspired by it. I actually haven't read all the way to the end, so I'm looking forward to finishing it here over the next few days. I keep getting interrupted by life as I'm reading Abundance, but I also keep going back and rereading parts. There are sections of it that I just find so interesting. One is I have to congratulate Peter Diamandis for the amount of self-control he demonstrates in the section on incentive prizes, because he's got an awful lot to say about them and how much good they can do for the planet. And it's actually a fairly brief chapter, but it really makes the point, and it's really impressive. A big aha for me, a big lesson learned for me reading this was reading about the original incentive, actually not the original one, the one that inspired Diamandis. They've actually been going on for quite some time. They've been used throughout history to do interesting things like calculate latitude. There's a story in there about how Napoleon used an incentive prize, something like the X Prize, to develop a technique for canning food. Essentially the same technique for canning food that we use today, some guy did to win a cash prize from Napoleon. Okay, I mean, it's just amazing when you think about that. But the story is given about the $25,000 prize that was out there waiting for someone to claim for any pilot from one of the Allied countries from World War I who could fly either from New York City to Paris or from Paris to New York City.
Right.
And sad stories of the guys who tried and didn't make it happen. And obviously we know from history that Charles Lindbergh, Spirit of St. Louis, made it happen and collected the prize and, became the world's greatest aviator and in the process kicked off commercial passenger aviation, really launched that industry.
You can look at aviation. There's a dividing line before and after Lindbergh, because before it was just it was barnstormers, it was stunt guys. I mean, they did a little bit of delivery of mail, but it was not not a normal thing to fly. It became a normal thing after Lindbergh's flight. It became an industry after that. Excuse me.
Exactly. And one of the drivers of that I hadn't ever thought about, and that I guess I had read about in connection with the X Prize, but I had never really made this connection before, is they offer a $25,000 prize, and they actually got something like $200,000 spent on or $400,000 spent by the various teams trying to cross the Atlantic. So it was a 16-fold return on the investment of $25,000.
Apparently,
where else you get a
And apparently, Phil, that number is fairly constant among these incentive prizes.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's you see that kind of, that level of investment to win the prize across all of these incentive prizes. It's amazing. And why would anyone do that? Why would, well, for one thing, one team is not going to spend that, you know, that much, you know, to win the prize. That's the amount of money that all the teams together spend in an effort to win the prize. Okay.
Right.
But there's, it's often the case that the winning team spends more than the prize to win. Why would they do that? Well, Peter Diamantis and his co-author answer that. They say simply that, well, the people that win the prize understand that they will then be leading the industry in what amounts to a brand new industry. And so you get Spaceship One winning Peter Diamantis the X Prize there, and you know they win it. And does that pay for the amount of money they put into winning it? No, it does not. But now they get to be the ones that that open this industry to take people into outer space. They are the guys.
Sure, they know it, they know it, yeah, they know it's going to be worth it to them in the long run. Also,
right.
An interesting dynamic that I was really interested to read about is they start out saying, "Well, we'll do it for just under."
Yeah,
we're going to spend almost as much as the prize rewards. We'll just about break even on this thing. We'll make a little bit of money, but we'll do it for the glory, and we'll get the business going. And then by the time they get into it, they end up spending a little more than the prize would have won. But they reap it. They make it up in the back end, and even the non-winners develop technologies that are valuable to other people, that are of use to other people, and that they can end up profiting from too. And of course, the whole industry, just as it did with passenger aviation, commercial aviation, back in the 30s, thanks to what Lindbergh did. Now we see the same pattern repeating itself here in our era, from the winning of the X Prize to this birth of the commercial space industry, the commercial passenger space industry, which is happening before our eyes, and is following that same pattern, getting that same kind of return on an investment from the X Prize that the aviation industry got from that original prize. It's really astounding and fun to watch. And I see, Stephen, that we're actually just about out of time, aren't we?
We are out of time. The music tonight is My Barista by Sweet Diss and the Comebacks. Sweet Diss and the Comebacks were the band that played 2 weeks ago when we last had a show. Liked them well enough, I'm bringing them back for an encore, My Barista.
My Barista, well, that goes well with our coffee shop future discussion over on the Transparency Revolution. Well, great fun, Stephen. Maybe we'll pick this up next week, talk some more abundance. Maybe we'll get into that subject of dematerialization. Thank you all for being part of the program. For those who listen live, those listen via recording, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back again at the regular time next week. And until then, live to see it. We're just a couple of kids taking the long way home. I really should have known. I'm 20 something in blue, feeling it slip away. I'll see you another day. What do you want me to say? There's no harm in letting me stand, 'cause good luck charms are only pretend. However, she could watch the stars. Just in my dreams.